Robinson said, "My ma said the alcaldessa had a big fight with the king's man. He said the alcaldessa told him to stick those orders in his ear." "If I know the alcaldessa, she didn't say ear," Issa said. She grinned wickedly, and Sanson and Ram laughed. They just weren't getting it. Kip saw Issa look at Ram, just a quick glance, looking for his approval. As she found it, Kip saw her pleasure double, and he felt sick in his stomach. Again.
"What's going on, Kip?"
she asked. Big brown eyes, full lips, full curves, flawless skin. It was impossible to talk to her and not be aware of her beauty. Prettier even than Liv, really. And infinitely more here. Kip tried to find words. "People are coming to kill us, and I'm worried about some girl who doesn't even like me." From Green Bridge it was 300 or 400 paces to the nearest orange grove. There was precious little cover between the bridge and the trees.
"There are—"
Kip started, but Ram ran right over his words.
"If they conscript me, I'm going to volunteer to become a battle drafter," Ram said. "It's dangerous, I know, but if I have to leave everything I love here, I'm going to make something of myself."
He looked into the distance, off to a grand future. Kip wanted to punch him in his handsome, heroic face.
"Why don't you and Sanson run off?" Ram asked. "You know, hide from the big bad army. Issa and I want to say goodbye."
"Why can't you say goodbye with us here?"
Sanson asked. Issa blushed. Ram's eyes flashed.
"Seriously, you two, don't be arseholes, huh?"
he said, pretending to be joking.
"Ram, listen," Kip said. "The army is coming to make an example of us. We need to leave. Right now. Master Danavis said they'd seize the bridge."
In fact, Green Bridge itself was a relic from the last army that came through. It was all green Luxon, the most durable Luxon. When sealed, it broke down more slowly than any other kind. They said that when Gavin Gyle had led his army through here on his way to crush his evil brother Dazen Gyle's army, Gavin Gyle, the Prism himself, had drafted this bridge. By himself. In seconds. The army had pushed through without slowing, though its foragers had stolen all the food and livestock still in town. All the men in the town had been pressed into service on one side or the other. It was why they had all grown up without fathers. No one in Recton should treat an army passing through as a light matter. Not even the children.
"Do me a favour, Tubby. I'll make it up to you," Ram said.
"If you go with the soldiers, you won't be here to make it up to me," Kip said.
He wanted to kill Ram when he called him Tubby. An ugly look passed over Ram's features. They'd fought before, and Ram won every time. But it was never easy. Kip could take a lot of punishment, and sometimes he went crazy. They both knew it. Ram said,
"So, do me a favour, huh?"
"We have to go!"
Kip nearly shouted. He didn't know why he was surprised. It was no mistake they always called Ramir Ram. He picked a goal and went straight at it, bashing down anything in his path, never veering right or left. His goal today was to take Isabel's maidenhead. That simple. No mere invading army was going to stop the stupid animal.
"Fine. Come on, Issa. We'll go to the orange grove," Ram said.
"I don't think I'll forget this, Kip."
Ram took her hand and pulled her into a walk. She went with him, but turned, looking over her shoulder at Kip as if expecting him to do something. But what could he do? They were actually going the right direction. If he went over there and punched Ram in the face, Ram would beat him bloody, and worse, they'd both be out in the open. If Kip followed on their heels, Ram might assume he was trying to start a fight even if he wasn't, with the same result. Isabel was still looking at him. She was so beautiful it hurt. Kip could stay. Do nothing. Hide under the bridge.
"No,"
Kip cursed. Issa looked back as he emerged from Green Bridge's shadow. Her eyes widened, and he thought he saw the shadow of a smile touch her lips. Real joy at seeing Kip pursue her and be a man. Or just venal delight in being fought over? Then her gaze shifted up and left, to the opposite bank of the river. Surprised. There was a man's yell from above, but over the hiss of the waters Kip couldn't understand what he said. Ram stumbled as he reached the top of the riverbank. He didn't catch himself. Instead, he dropped to his knees, tottered, and fell backward. It was only when Ram's limp body rolled over that Kip saw the arrow sticking out of his back. Issa saw it too. She looked at whoever was on the bank, glanced at Kip, and then bolted in the other direction.
"Kill her!"
a man commanded in a loud, clear voice on the bridge directly above Kip. His voice was passionless. Kip felt sick, helpless. He'd wasted too much time. His mind refused what his eyes reported. Issa was running along the bank of the river, fast. She'd always been fast, but there was nowhere to hide, no cover from the arrow Kip knew was coming. His heart hammered in his chest, roared in his ears, and then suddenly its rate doubled, tripled. The barest shadow flicked at the corner of his eye, the arrow. Kip's arm spasmed as if he himself had been struck. A flash of blue, barely visible, thin and reedy, darted from him into the air. The arrow splashed into the river a good 15 paces away from Issa. The archer cursed. Kip looked down at his hands. They were trembling. And blue. As achingly bright blue as the sky. He was so stunned he froze for a moment. He looked back to Issa, now more than 100 paces away. There was the same flicker of a shadow as another arrow passed from the periphery of his vision to the center of it, right into Issa's back. She pitched face first onto the rough stones of the riverbank, but as Kip watched, she got back up to her knees slowly, the arrow jutting from her lower back, hands and face streaming blood. She was almost to her feet when the next arrow thudded into her back. She dropped face first into the shallows of the river and moved no more. Kip stood there stupidly, disbelieving. His vision narrowed to the point where crimson life swirled from Issa's back into the clear water of the river. Hoofbeats clopped loudly on the bridge above them. Kip's mind churned.
"Sir, the men are ready," the man said above them. "But, sir, this is our own town."
Kip looked up. The green luxon of the bridge overhead was translucent, and he could see the shadows of the men, which meant that if he or Sanson moved, the soldiers might see them too. Silence. Then, coldly, the same officer who had demanded Issa die said, "Though we should let subjects choose when to obey their king, perhaps obeying my orders should be optional too."
"No, sir, it's just—"
"Are you finished?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then burn it down. Kill them all."
Chapter 7
"You're not even going to pretend that you don't read my mail?" Gavin asked. The white barked a laugh.
"Why insult your intelligence?"
"I could think of half a dozen reasons, which means you could probably think of 100, Gavin said.
"You're avoiding the question. Do you have a son?"
Despite her dogged determination to get the answer, and Gavin knew she wouldn't let him dodge this, artfully or not, she kept her voice down. She understood, better than anyone, the gravity of the situation. Even the blackguards wouldn't hear this, but if she had read his unsealed mail, anyone else could have too.
"To the best of my knowledge, it's not true. I don't see how it could be."
"Because you've been careful, or because it's actually impossible?"
"You don't really expect me to answer that," Gavin said.
"I understand that a prison faces substantial temptations, and I appreciate your temperance or discretion over the years, whichever it's been. I haven't had to deal with pregnant young drafters or irate fathers demanding that you be forced to marry their daughters. I thank you for that. In return, I haven't joined your father in pressing you to marry, though that would doubtless simplify your life and mine. You're a smart man, Gavin. Smart enough, I hope, that you know you can ask me for a new room slave, or more room slaves, or whatever you require. Otherwise, I hope that you are very careful."
Gavin coughed. "None more so."
"I don't pretend to be able to track all your comings and goings, but to the best of my knowledge, you haven't been to Tyria since the war."
16 years, Gavin said quietly. 16 years. Has he really been down there for 16 years?
What would the White do if she found out my brother is alive?
That I've been keeping him
in a special hell beneath this very tower. Her eyebrows lifted, reading something else in his troubled expression.
Ah, a great many things may be done during war by men and women who think they may die. Those were wilder days for you. So perhaps this revelation is a particular problem.
Gavin's heart stopped cold. For all of a thousand things that had happened 16 years ago, the one that was most important now was that during the time the child must have been sad, Gavin had been betrothed to Caris.
If you're absolutely certain that this isn't true, the White said, I'll send a man to take the note from Caris. I was trying to do you a favour. You know her temper. I figured it would be best for both of you if she learned about this while she is away. After her head cools, I imagine she'll forgive you. But if you swear it isn't true, then there's no need for her to know at all, is there?
For a moment, Gavin wondered at the old crone. The White was being kind, no doubt, but she had also orchestrated this situation to happen right in front of her. And the only reason for her to do that was so she could see Gavin's most honest reaction. It was kind and cruel and cunning all at once, and by no means accidental. Gavin reminded himself for the 100th time not to get on the wrong side of Aurea Polar. I have no recollection of this woman. None. But it was a terrible time. I cannot swear it. He knew how the White would take that. She thought he was admitting to cheating on Caris during their betrothal, but that he believed he'd always been careful. But young men make mistakes. I should go, he said. I'll get to the bottom of it. This is my mess.
No, she said flatly. Now it's Caris's. I'm not sending you to Tyria, Gavin. You're the prison. It's bad enough that I have to send you after colour whites.
You don't send me. You just don't stop me. It had been their first titanic clash of wills. She refused to let a prism endanger himself, called it madness. Gavin hadn't made any arguments at all, just refused to be stopped. She'd confined him to his apartments. He'd blown the doors off. Eventually she gave in, and he paid for it in other ways. A moment passed, and she said very quietly, gently,
After all this time, Gavin, after all the whites you've killed, and all the people you've saved, does it hurt any less?
I hear there's some talk of heresy, Gavin said brusquely. Someone preaching the old gods again. I could go find out.
You're not the Promarchus anymore, Gavin.
It's not like any 50 of their half-trained drafters could stop.
What you are is the best prism we've had in 50, maybe 100 years. And they might have 51 drafters, or 500 of their little heretical Chromeria, so I won't hear of it.
Caris will check on this woman and her son and see what she can learn as she investigates this King Charadul.
You can expect her return within 2 months. And speaking of colour whites, an unusually powerful blue white was just seen on the outskirts of the Blood Forest, heading toward Rue.
A blue white, heading toward the reddest lands in the world. Odd. And blues were usually so logical. It was a distraction, but it was a good one, and it left him almost no time to reach Caris. By your leave, then, High Lady, he said, his good manners always partly ironical. He didn't wait for her approval before he gathered his magic and jogged toward the edge of the tower.
Oh, no, you don't, she said.
He stopped, sighed. What?
Gavin, she scolded. Surely you didn't forget you promised to teach today. It's a high honour for each class to meet with you. They wait months for this.
Which class? He asked suspiciously.
Superviolets. There's only 6 of them.
Isn't that the class with the girl always spilling out of her top? Lana? Anna? It was one thing when women pursued Gavin, but that girl had been throwing herself at him since she was 14. The White looked pained.
We have spoken with that one a few times.
Look, Gavin said, the tide is going out. I have to catch Caris. I'll teach that class next time you see me. No excuses, no fight.
You give me your word?
I give you my word. The White smiled like a sated cat.
You enjoy teaching more than you admit, don't you, Gavin?
Gah, Gavin said. Goodbye. Before she could say anything else, he sprinted for the edge of the tower and leapt into space. Chapter 8 Kip was staring at Issa's body. After she'd seen the soldiers kill Ram, she'd looked back at Kip. She'd been looking for safety, for protection. She'd looked at him, and she'd known he couldn't save her. A sound and a sudden absence next to him made Kip tear his eyes away from Issa. Sanson was running toward the village. Sanson wasn't smart, but he'd always been practical. He hadn't done anything so dumb in his life. But Kip couldn't blame him. They'd never seen anyone die, either. But there was no way the soldiers could fail to see Sanson, and now he'd die too if Kip didn't do anything. Kip had stood around enough, doing nothing, while his friends died. He didn't think. He acted. He ran. The other way. Kip hated running. When Ram ran, it was like watching a hunting hound speed after a deer, all hard, lean muscles and flowing strength. When Issa ran, it was like watching the deer flee, all easy grace and surprising speed. Kip running was like a milk cow lumbering out to pasture. Still, no one was expecting him. He made it to Ram's body and to full speed before he heard a shout. He crashed up the bank of the river, barely slowing. Once he got his mass moving, it took a lot to stop him. A dead tree, its trunk rising to shin level, mostly hidden in the long grasses, counted as a lot. Kip's shin cracked into wood in mid-stride, and he pitched forward. He skidded on his face and then flopped over like a fish. Pain blurred his vision black and red. For a second he thought he was going to throw up, then he went light-headed. He looked down, fully expecting bone to be jutting out of his leg. Nothing. Wimp. Tears streamed from his eyes. His hands were bleeding again, fingernails torn. He heard the men on the bridge shouting. They'd lost him for the moment, but horsemen were coming. He wasn't 50 paces away. The grasses were only knee-high. The horsemen would see him any second now, and then he'd die, just like Issa. He staggered to his feet, his shin afire, tears blurring the world. He hated himself, crying because he fell down. Because he was clumsy, because he was weak. The horsemen gave a yell as he stood. Kip had seen King Haradul's horsemen pass through town before, but never in full battle harness. When they passed through Rekton, their harnesses were always stowed. Rekton wasn't even big enough to be worth showing off for. The two horsemen galloping toward Kip were both part of the lower cavalry. Barely able to afford their own ponies, weapons, and armor, they served only during the dry season. Amateur warriors, hoping to bring home loot and lies before the harvests. Both were dressed in mail and plate jackets. Lighter and cheaper than the full plate worn by the lords and King Haradul's mirrormen, these long jackets bore six narrow rows of thin, overlapping plates down the front, with 4-to-1 riveted mail for the sleeves and back. Each wore a taupe, a round helmet with a spike on top and vulture plumes sticking up beside them. A mail avantail, draped down over the shoulders, protecting the neck and giving double-thickness mail over the upper chest. Neither carried a lance. Instead, they bore vesheverals, sickle swords. The weapons had a long handle like an axe, and a crescent moon-shaped blade at the end, with the inward bowl-shaped side being the cutting edge. The horsemen were jostling each other for the better line, laughing, competing to see who would hack the child. The laughter did it. It was one thing to give up and die. It was something else to let some giggling morons murder you. But there was no time. The horsemen had reached a full gallop, trampling the tender, radiant green grass the way they would trample Kip. They finally split, one switching his vesheveral to his left hand so they could cut Kip down simultaneously. Kip lashed out, jumping, determined to at least punch one stupid grin to oblivion before he died. It was a poor jump, and far too early. But as Kip's body rose to meet the extended lances, a radiant green mass rose through him. He felt energy rush out from his body. A dozen blades of grass rose through his hand with his punch, tearing his skin as they ripped out of him. They thickened to the width of boar spears as green light poured from him and became blades in truth. As he threw them into the air, Kip was thrown back down to the ground. The butts of a dozen radiant jade spears thunked into the ground around him. The horsemen barely had time to jerk on their reins before they rammed into a wall of spears. Their vashevrals went flying out of their hands as their horses were impaled, lifted off the ground by the angle of the spears, snapping those in front with the force of their impact, only to find more behind those and be impaled further. The riders were thrown from their saddles into the waiting green spears. The lighter of the two caught and was held 5 feet off the ground. The heavier rider snapped off the spears and fell flat on his back beside Kip. For a long, stupid moment, Kip had no idea what had happened. He heard a shout from the bridge.
"Drafter! Green Drafter!"
He looked at his hands. Radiant green was slowly leaking from his bloody fingertips, the exact shade of the grass and the spears. There were cuts at his knuckles, wrists, and under his nails, like something had ripped the skin on its way out. A scent like resin and cedar filled the air. Kip felt woozy. Someone was cursing in a low, desperate voice. He turned. It was the soldier, bleeding on the ground near him. Kip had no idea how the man was still alive. There were 4 spears through his body, but they were disappearing now, bowing under their own weight, shimmering as if on some tiny level they were boiling away into nothingness. The soldier sucked in a breath. The movement made the 2 spears through his chest shift. The soldier whimpered and cursed. And slowly the spears disappeared, leaving only chalky green grit to mix with his blood. Despite the mail hanging askew across the man's face, Kip could see the gleam of his dark eyes, shining with tears. For a few moments, Kip had felt connected. The green was unity, growth, wildness, wholeness. But as it slipped from his fingers, the great spears bowing like wilting flowers, he felt alone. Once more, scared. The smaller rider who'd been held off the ground was released with a thump and the clanging of mail as he hit the ground. The spears shimmered, dissipated, and blew apart like heavy dust. Kip heard weeping. It was the bigger rider, still cursing. The man drew in a great breath and abruptly coughed, spitting blood all through the mail over his face. He turned over onto his stomach, and more blood poured out of his broken toe. Kip turned away. He looked toward the bridge. The king's soldiers were gone. Kip could only guess that they had assumed that some trained drafter had shown up to rescue him. Maybe they would wait until dark to come after him, or maybe they had their own drafter back at camp. Either way, Kip had to run. Fast. He turned on wobbly legs, fingers stinging, his brain thick with grief and exhaustion, and stumbled toward the orange grove. Chapter 9 Gavin Gyle plunged past classrooms and barracks, and knew that not a few people would rush to the windows to see what came next. In fact, this was the first day of drafting classes for the Dims, so he was probably about to be a perfect illustration of one of the primary lessons every magister taught. The magister would light a candle and instruct the students to comment on what was happening. This always gave the magisters plenty of opportunities to abuse the bewildered children, who would invariably say, "It's burning." "But what do you mean by this word, burning?"
"It's burning?"
The eventual point was that every fire began on something tangible and left almost nothing tangible. When a candle burned, where did all the tallow go? Into power. Power we experience as light and heat, with some residue. Whether much or little depended on how efficiently the candle burned. Magic was the converse. It began with power, light or heat, and its expression was always physical. You made Luxin. You could touch it, hold it, or be held by it. Halfway down, Gavin drafted a blue bonnet and a harness from the cold blue of the sky, with some green added for flexibility. It unfurled with a pop, and slowed his fall. When he was a few paces from the ground, he threw down blast waves of sub-red that slowed him enough that he could land lightly in the street. The bonnet dissolved into blue dust and green grit and a smell like resin, chalk and cedar. He strode toward the docks. He found her within minutes, just arriving at the docks herself, a bag slung over her shoulder. She'd changed from her blackguard uniform but was still wearing pants. Caris only wore a dress once a year for the Lux Lord's Ball, where it was required. She'd also somehow dyed her hair almost black, so as not to stand out so much in Tyria. Of course, it was impossible not to stand out with those eyes, like an emerald sky adorned with ruby stars. Caris was a green-red bichrome, almost a polychrome. It was an almost she'd hated all her life. Her red arc extended into the sub-red so far that she could draft fire, but she couldn't draft stable sub-red Luxon. She'd failed the examination twice. It didn't matter that she could draft more sub-red than most sub-red drafters, or that she was the fastest drafter Gavin had ever seen. She wasn't a polychrome. But on the other hand, polychromes were too valuable to be allowed to join the Blackguard. "Caris!" Gavin called out, jogging to catch up with her. She stopped and waited for him, a quizzical look on her face. "Lord Prism," she said in greeting, ever proper in public, and still, evidently, not having read the note. He fell in step beside her. "So," he said, "Tyria." "The armpit of the seven satrapies itself," she said. 5 years, 5 great purposes, Gavin. He'd given himself purposes since he'd first become Prism, as a focus and distraction. 7 goals for each 7-year stint, and the first was... The first had always been to tell Caris the whole truth, a truth that might ruin everything. What I did. Why. And why I broke our betrothal 15 years ago. "And you can rot in that blue hell forever for that, brother." "Important mission," he said. She shrugged.
"How come the important missions never take me to Hrothgar, or the Blood Forest?"
He chuckled. Hrothgar was the most civilized and prosperous nation in the Seven Satrapies, and, of course, as a green drafter, Caris would feel a strong fondness for the verdant plains. Alternately, the Blood Forest was where her people were from, and she hadn't walked among the redwoods since she was young. "Why don't you make it a quick trip, then? I can scull you there."
"To Tyria? It's on the opposite side of the sea."
"It's on my way to a colour white I've got to deal with. And I may not have many more chances to be near you." She scowled.
"Seems like there have been a lot of whites recently."
"It always seems like there have been a lot recently. Remember last summer when there were 6 in 6 days and then none for 3 months?"
"I guess so."
"What kind?" she asked. Like most drafters, she felt a special outrage when a white had come from her own colour. "A blue."
"Ah. So I'm guessing you'll be right on your way."
Caris knew about Gavin's special hatred for blue whites.
"Wait, you're hunting a blue white in Tyria?" she asked, turning to look at him with her haunting green eyes with red flecks.
"Outside Rue, actually." He cleared his throat. She laughed. At 32, she had the faintest lines on her face, more frown lines than smile lines, sadly, but she still had the same dimples. It just wasn't fair. After years of knowing her, a woman's beauty shouldn't be able to reach straight into a man's chest and squeeze the breath out of him, especially not when he could never have her.
"Tyria's 1,000 leagues from Rue."
"Couple hundred at most. If you stop wasting daylight arguing with me, I might be able to get you there before nightfall."
"Gavin, that's impossible. Even for you. And even if it were possible, I couldn't ask you—"
"You didn't. I volunteered. Now tell me, would you really prefer to spend 2 weeks on a corvette? It's clear today, but you know how those storms come up. I heard the last time you sailed you got so green you could draft off your own skin."
"Gavin."
"Important mission, isn't it?" he asked.
"The white's going to kill you for this. She's got an ulcer named after you, you know. Literally."
"I'm the Prism. There's got to be some advantages. And I like sculling."
"You're impossible," she said, surrendering.
"We all have our special little talents."
Chapter 10.
Kip woke to the smell of oranges and smoke. It was still hot, the evening sun slipping through the leaves to tickle his face. Somehow he had made it to one of the orange groves before collapsing. He looked down the long, perfect rows for any soldiers before he stood up. His head still felt foggy, but the smell of smoke drove away any thoughts of himself. As he approached the edge of the orange grove, the stench grew stronger, the air thick. Kip caught flashes of light in the distance. He emerged from the grove and saw the sun setting behind the Alcaldesa's mansion, the tallest building in Recton. As he watched, the sun went from a beautiful deep red to something darker, angry. Then Kip saw the light again. Fire. Thick smoke billowed suddenly into the sky, and as if on signal, smoke billowed up from a dozen places in the town. In moments, the smoke blossomed to raging fires, towering dozens of paces above the roofs. Kip heard screams. A ruin of an old statue lay in the orange grove. The townsfolk had always called it the Broken Man. Much of it had dissolved in the centuries since its fall, but the head mostly remained. Someone had long ago carved steps into the broken neck. The head was tall enough to watch the sun rise over the orange trees. It was a favorite spot for couples. Kip clambered up the steps. The town was on fire. Hundreds of foot soldiers surrounded the town in a vast, loose circle. As the flames drove some townsfolk from their hiding place, Kip saw King Haradul's horsemen set their lances. It was old Miss Del Clara and her six sons, the quarrymen. The biggest one, Mikael, was carrying her over one burly shoulder. He was shouting at the others, but Kip couldn't hear what he was saying. The brothers ran together toward the river, apparently hoping to find safety there. They weren't going to make it. The horsemen lowered their lances as they reached a full gallop, maybe 30 paces away from the fleeing family.
"Now!"
Mikael yelled. Kip could hear it from where he stood. Five of the brothers dropped to the ground. Zalo was too slow. A lance punched through his back and sent him sprawling. Two of the others were skewered as their pursuers quickly adjusted their aim and caught the men low to the ground. Mikael's pursuer dipped his lance too but missed. He caught the ground instead, and the lance stuck. The horseman didn't release his lance in time and was slammed out of his saddle by the force of his own charge. Mikael ran over to the fallen soldier and drew the man's own vercheval. With a savage chop, despite the layers of mail, he nearly cut the man's head off. But the other horsemen had drawn rein already, and in seconds there was a forest of flashing steel blocking Mikael, his brother, and his mother from Kip's view. Kip felt like he was going to throw up. At some signal he didn't see or hear, the horsemen formed back up and charged off toward new victims in the distance. Kip was only glad that they were far enough away he couldn't recognize them. Around the rest of the town, the foot soldiers were moving in.
Mother!
Kip had been watching the town burn for several minutes, and he hadn't thought about anything. His mother was in there. He had to go to her. How was he going to get into the town? Even if he could get past the soldiers and the fire, was his mother even still alive? But the king's men had seen the direction he had run away to. They would think that the drafter they'd seen earlier was the only threat in the whole area. Surely they would be watching for him. In fact, they might have men out hunting him now. If so, perching on the highest point in the orange grove was probably not the smartest thing to do. As if on signal, Kip heard a branch snap. It might have been a deer. Evening was coming on, after all. There were lots of deer in the orange groves after... Not 30 paces away, someone cursed.
Talking deer?
Kip dropped to his stomach. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't move. They were going to kill him, just like they'd killed the Del Claras. Mikael Del Clara was big, tough as old oak, and they'd slaughtered him.
Move, Kip. Just move.
His heart was a riot in his chest. He was shaking. He was taking tiny breaths, way too fast. Slow down, Kip. Breathe. He took a deep breath and tore his eyes away from his trembling hands. There was a cave, not far from here. Kip had found his mother there once after she'd disappeared for 3 days. There'd long been rumors of smugglers' caves in the area, and whenever his mother ran out of haze and money, she went looking for them. She'd finally gotten lucky about 2 years ago and found enough of the drug that she hadn't come home.
When Kip had found her, she hadn't eaten for days. She'd nearly died. He'd overheard someone saying aloud that they wished she had, for his sake. Reaching the ground, Kip started jogging, trying to keep the ruin between himself and the man he'd heard. He ran about as fast as Sanson would run if Sanson carried another Sanson on his back. So Kip jogged, trying to be quiet, zigzagging through the straight rows of trees. Then he heard a sound that froze his bones to the marrow. Dogs barking. Fueled by fear, Kip found a flat-out run. He ignored the burning in his legs, the stabbing in his lungs. He was already headed toward the river. The cave was on its banks. He heard a soldier shouting curses, maybe 200 paces back, maybe less. "Keep those dogs on the lead! You want to find a drafter while it's still light out?" It was getting darker by the minute. So that was why he was still alive. With all colors muted by darkness, drafters weren't nearly as powerful at night. And between the smoke and a bank of black clouds rolling in, the sky was darkening faster than normal. If they'd let the dogs go, they'd have run him down already. But with darkness coming on so fast, they might feel safe to let them go at any minute. Suddenly, Kip was on the riverbank. He stepped on one pant leg and almost fell down, barely catching himself with one hand. He stopped. The cave was upstream, away from town, not 200 paces away. He picked up two stones that fit nicely in his hands. If he had the cave to protect his sides and back, he could... what? Die slowly? He looked at the rocks in his hands. Rocks. Against soldiers and war dogs. He was stupid. Insane. He looked at the rocks again, then threw one onto the opposite bank of the river downstream. He threw the second rock farther. Then he grabbed two more, rubbed them against his body, and threw them as far as he could. The last one crashed through the branches of a willow tree. Lousy throw. No time to mourn his ineptitude. Kip's scent trail already was headed upstream, the direction he did need to go. He'd just have to hope. It was a pathetic attempt, but he had nothing else. He kept moving upstream, up the bank, trying to ignore the sound of the barking dogs closing in. Then he stepped into the river, careful not to let his clothes touch any dry rocks. The place where he had come to the river was a bend, so soon he was out of the line of sight. "Let the dogs go!" the same voice shouted. Then Kip was opposite the cave entrance. It was invisible from the river, obscured by boulders that had fallen in front of the opening. But as soon as he stepped out of the river, he'd be leaving scent for the dogs, and a visual trail of wet rocks for the soldiers. He couldn't get out of the water. Not yet. He looked up at the black clouds. "Don't just sit there. Give me some rain."
"What's the problem? What's wrong with them?"
the soldier demanded.
"They're fighting dogs, sir, not trackers. I'm not even certain they're on the drafter's trail."
Kip kept pushing upstream another 100 paces where the bend in the river straightened out and a tree had fallen down the bank into the water. It wouldn't do anything for the scent trail, but it would hide the water he was dripping. He cut up the bank and then stopped. If he headed back downstream, he'd be going closer to the men hunting him. But the soldier's mention of other trails had put a small desperate hope in Kip's breast. Other trails meant maybe other fresh trails. And if it weren't for the dogs, the cave would be the safest place to spend the night. Swallowing, so his heart didn't jump out of his throat, Kip turned downstream toward the cave. He thought he felt a cool prick on his skin. Rain? He looked up at the black clouds, but it must have been his imagination. He came to the spot overlooking the cave's entrance. Two soldiers were standing almost directly below him. Two others were on the opposite bank. There was one war dog on each side. Either dog's head would have come up to Kip's shoulder, easily. They both wore studded leather coats, like horse armor without the saddle. Kip dropped to the ground.
"Sir, if I may..."
one of the men said. Apparently getting permission, the soldier said,
"The drafter came straight to the river, then veered sharply upstream before going into the water. He knows we're following him. I think he doubled back and went downstream."
"With us so close behind?" the commander asked.
"He must have heard the dogs."
Which made Kip think of something else. Dogs can smell scents on the wind, too, not just on the ground. Kip's throat tightened. He hadn't even thought about the wind. It was blowing from the southwest. His path had taken him east and then north when the river turned, the perfect direction.
If he'd gone downstream toward town, the dogs would have smelled him immediately. If the commander thought about it, he'd surely realize that too.
"Rain's coming. We might only have one shot at this."
The commander paused.
"Let's make it fast."
He whistled and gestured for the men on the other side of the river to head downstream. They took off at a jog. Kip's heart started to beat again. He slipped down the bank beside two great boulders. There was a narrow space between the two. It looked like it went in for about 4 paces and then stopped, but Kip knew that it turned sharply. He never would have discovered it the first time if it hadn't been for the pungent, sickly, sweet odour of haze floating out. Or Hollum knew how his mother had ever found it. Now, even knowing it was there, Kip almost didn't have the courage to push between those rocks. There was something wrong, though. It wasn't as dark as it should be. It was fully night outside, and Kip was blocking the entrance, so someone was already inside, and they had a lantern. Kip froze again, until he heard the sound of the war dogs change pitch. They'd found the rocks he'd thrown across the river. That meant it was only a matter of time until they discovered his fraud. The darkness and tightness were suffocating. He had to move, one way or the other. He pushed around the corner and into the open space of the smuggler's cave. There were two figures sitting in the wan light of a lantern. Sanson and Kip's mother. Both were covered in blood. Chapter 11. Kip couldn't help but cry out. His mother was seated against the wall of the cave, her once blue dress dyed black and red with blood dried and fresh. Lena's dark hair was matted, darker than normal, stringy with blood. The right side of her face was pristine, perfect. All the blood was coming from the left side of her head, travelling down her hair like a wick, blooming on her dress. Sanson sat next to her. His eyes closed, head back, clothes almost as gory. At Kip's cry, his mother's eyes fluttered. There was a huge dent in the side of her head. Or Hollum be merciful. Her skull was shattered. She stared in his direction for several moments before she found him. Her eyes were a horror to behold. The pupil of her left eye was dilated, the right a tight pinprick. And the whites of both were completely bloodshot.
"Kip," she said, "never thought I'd be so happy to see you."
"Love you too, mother," he said, trying to keep his tone light.
"My fault," she said.
Her eyes fluttered and closed. Kip's heart seized. Was she dead? Before today, he'd never seen anyone die.
Or Hollum, this was his mother.
He looked at Sanson, who looked healthy despite all the blood on his clothes.
"I tried, Kip. The Alcaldessa wouldn't listen. I told her." "Even his own family didn't believe him," Kip's mother said,
her eyes still closed.
"Even when the soldiers rode down his mother and split his brother open, Aidan Marta stood there, arguing how our satrap wouldn't possibly do such a thing to his own people. Only Sanson ran away. Who would have thought he was the smart one in that family?"
"Mother, enough," Kip's voice came out whiny, childish.
"You came back, though, didn't you, Sanson? Tried to save me. Unlike my own son. Too bad he didn't try to help me like you tried to help your family. Or I might still have a chance."
Her words touched some deep well of rage, potent but uncontrollable. He pushed it down, pushed the tears back.
"Mother, stop. You're dying. Sanson says you're a drafter now." "Funny," she said bitterly. "All your life you're a disappointment, and you learn to draft today. Too late for any of us."
With effort she took a deep breath, then opened her eyes and fixed her gaze on Kip, taking a little while to focus.
"Kill him, Kip. Kill the bastard."
She lifted a narrow, filigreed rosewood jewellery case as long as Kip's forearm from the floor of the cave beside her. Kip had never seen it before. Kip took the case and opened it. There was a dagger inside, double-edged, of an odd material, starkly white, like ivory, with a thread of black winding down the centre to the point, and no other adornment save for 7 diamonds embedded in the blade itself. It was the most beautiful thing Kip had ever seen, and he didn't care. He had no idea what the blade was worth, but the case it had come in alone would have paid for a month of his mother's binges.
Mother? What is this?
And I thought Sanson was slow, she said, hard, sneering, dying, afraid. Put it in his rotten heart. Make that bastard suffer. Make him pay for this.
Mother, what are you saying?
Kip asked, despairing. Me kill King Haradul? She laughed, and the motion made a fresh wash of blood spill down her head.
You're a stupid, stupid boy, Kip. But maybe a dull sword can go where a sharp one wouldn't be allowed.
Her head bobbed. Her breathing was getting laboured. Her head drooped to her chest, and Kip thought she was dead. But her eyes opened once more, only one focusing, locking Kip in her glare. Her fingernails dug into his forearm painfully.
You go. Go train to be a drafter. Go to the...
She seemed to be searching for the word Chromeria, but couldn't find it. She noticed, looked furious, afraid. It was evidence she really was dying.
You learn what you need, but don't you forget me. Don't you forget this. Don't listen to him. You hear me? He's a liar. You will not fail me in this, Kip. You learn, and then you kill him. You understand?
Yes, Mother.
She was talking like she knew King Haradul. How could she have known him?
Kip, if you ever loved me, avenge me. Swear it by your worthless soul, Kip. Swear it, or I swear to Orholm I'll haunt you. I won't let...
She lost her train of thought. Kip looked over at Sanson, who stared back silently, horrified. Kip's mother's fingernails dug in deeper, and her seeing eye seemed almost aflame, demanding his attention, his promise. He said,
I swear to avenge you, Mother, by my very soul.
Something like peace stole over her features, softening the hard planes. Then she laughed, quietly, satisfied, somehow cruel, until her laughter stopped. A hand dropped from Kip's forearm, leaving bloody tracks.
I won't let you down, Mother. I'll go right...
She's dead. Kip stared at her woodenly, inexplicably numb. He closed her awful, bloodshot eyes.
Are you hurt? Kip asked.
Huh?
Sanson asked.
Me?
Kip stared at him. No, genius, I'm talking to the dead person. It was cruel. Thoughtless. Sanson's eyes welled up with tears.
Oh, I'm sorry, Kip. I tried to get her out. Oh, it's too late.
He was right on the verge of breaking down. Kip was an ass. No, Sanson, no, I'm sorry. Don't talk like that. It's not your fault. Listen to me. We need to act right now, not think. We're in danger.
Are you hurt?
Sanson's eyes cleared and his chin lifted. He met Kip's gaze.
No, this blood is all... No, I'm fine.
Then we need to go right now, while it's dark and raining. They've got dogs. They can track us. It's our only chance.
But, Kip, where are we going to go?
Odd. Just like that. Kip was the leader. Was it that he'd found some new well of strength, or was Sanson just that weak? No, don't even think like that, Kip. He trusts you. Can't that be enough? What if I'm not worthy of trust? I'm going to be a drafter, Kip said.
I guess.
So we need to get to the sea. We should be able to find a ship in Garriston that's going to the Chromeria. Sanson's eyes widened, obviously thinking about what Kip's mother had sworn him to. But he said nothing, but...
How do we get to Garriston?
We float the river first. Kip realized then that he'd lost the purse Master Danavis had given him. He didn't even know when. so even if they made it down the river, they wouldn't be able to pay for the trip to the Cremeria.
Kit, the soldiers were in a big circle around the whole town. If they're still like that, we'll have to cross through their line twice, and the town's still on fire. The river could be blocked.
Sansom was right, and for some reason that made Kip suddenly furious. He stopped himself. This wasn't Sansom's fault. Kip's eyes felt hot. It was so hopeless. He blinked rapidly.
I know it's stupid, Sansom.
He couldn't look his friend in the eyes.
But I don't have any other ideas. Do you?
Sansom paused for a long moment.
I saw some dead wood on the bank that might work,
he said finally. And Kip knew it was his way of telling Kip he trusted him.
Then let's go,
Kip said.
Kip, do you want to, I don't know, say goodbye?
Sansom nodded in the direction of Kip's mother. Kip swallowed, holding the knife case in a white-knuckled grip. And say what? I'm sorry I was a failure, a disappointment, that I loved you even if you never loved me?
No, he said. Let's go.
Chapter 12 The boys crept out of the cave. Kip went first. Apparently that was the price of becoming the leader. Kip had been under these same stars on the river dozens of times, but tonight there was hunger in the cool air. The wind had changed direction, and now the smells of the light, misting rain, opening the earth, mingled with wood smoke, and the faint, fresh fragrance of the oranges ripening on the trees. Always before, that scent had cheered Kip. Tonight it was faint, ephemeral, as fragile as Kip's chances. They made it to the river's edge without seeing any soldiers. They'd floated the river before, all four of them, grabbing a few planks of wood for extra buoyancy, but mostly just lying back and letting the current carry them. But they'd always waited until late fall, when the river was lower. Even then they'd all sported dozens of scrapes and bruises from the rocks they couldn't avoid. It was the middle of summer now, and though the river was lower than in the spring, it was still high and swift. That meant they would be able to float over rocks that would scrape them in the fall, but the rocks they couldn't avoid, they would hit much faster. Sansom found the sticks he'd seen before while Kip waited anxiously, trying to peer downriver for any hint of the soldiers. The clouds over the village were glowing orange, lit by the fires below them. Sansom returned with a few branches, not enough for both of them. The boys looked at each other.
You take them, Kip whispered. I float better than you.
What do we do if they see us?
Sansom asked. Kip's nerve almost failed him as he thought about it. What could they do? Run away? Swim away? Even if they made it to the banks of the river, where could they go? The town was on fire and there were only fields around town. Men on horses, with dogs helping them, would find Kip and Sansom in no time.
Play dead, Kip said.
After all, we shouldn't be the only bodies in the water. Actually, that wasn't true. This far upstream, they should be the only bodies in the water. If any of the soldiers realized that, the boys would quickly become real corpses. The water was cold even this far from the mountains, but it wasn't freezing. Kip sat down in it, and the current began pulling him toward town. Sansom followed. They were pulled around the first bend and approaching the spot where Kip had first come to the river when he saw the flaw in his plan. To play dead meant that in the sections of river that were most dangerous, the places where he and Sansom would most want to see or listen to find out if they'd been discovered, they'd have to keep their ears submerged and their eyes fixed on the clouds above. If they were discovered, Kip's plan guaranteed that they wouldn't know it until too late. They should get out of the water. He couldn't do this. Kip glanced back. Sansom was already lying back, floating on his back, ears covered, limbs loose. He'd been pulled over to the other side of the river, and the current had already brought his lighter body even with Kip. Kip's heart hammered. If he got out now, Sansom wouldn't know it. Kip wouldn't be able to grab his friend without making so much noise that it would rouse anyone within hundreds of paces. A voice spoke out of the gloom on the riverbank.
Yes, Your Majesty. We think the drafter climbed up into that tree. The dogs tracked him that far and lost him.
Kip saw the torch first. Someone was approaching the bank of the river, not 5 paces downstream. His first thought, to run like hell, would get him killed. He swept his arms once, twice, paddling downstream. Then he lay back. The cold water closed over his ears, muffling all sound except the desperate thumping of his pulse. A bank here was raised a pace and a half, high enough that even lying back, Kip could see the man. Kip wasn't 2 paces away, and the torch the man held illuminated an imperious face in its flickering orange light. Even warmed in torchlight, there was something fundamentally cold about that face, an unpleasant smirk hiding in the corner of that mouth. The king. For Kip had no doubt, even in half a second of seeing him, that this man was King Haradul, was not yet out of his 20s, but already half-bald, with the rest of his hair combed to his shoulders. He had a prominent nose over a tight, immaculate beard and thick, black brows. The king stared upstream, a vein on his forehead visible even in the torchlight, gazing at the opposite bank where Kip had crossed. His angry question was barely more than a murmur through the water closed around Kip's ears. Then the king turned just as Kip was starting to get downstream of him, and he turned left, toward Kip. Kip didn't move a muscle, but it wasn't because he was being smart. He felt warmth blooming in the cold water between his legs. It was only the torch directly between the king and Kip that saved the boys. His eyes went right over them, but blinded by that light in the darkness, he saw nothing. He turned, swore something, and disappeared. Kip floated down the river, head back, almost disbelieving that he was alive. The water was cold around him, the stars were pinpricks in Orholam's mantle above. They were more beautiful than he'd ever realized. Each star had its own color, its own hue, brilliant rubies, startling sapphires, and even here and there an elusive emerald. For perhaps 20 paces, Kip floated in utter peace, enwrapped by the beauty. Then he hit a rock. It struck his foot first and spun him around so he was floating sideways. Then another rock, mostly submerged, caught his shirt and flipped him face down in the water. He gasped and flailed, freezing with fear as his head came clear of the water, and he realized how loud he'd been. A little way down the river, Sanson had pulled his head out of the water and was staring at Kip with horror. How could Kip make so much noise? Kip looked away, ashamed. They floated in silence for a long minute, staring into the darkness, waiting to see if any soldiers would appear. They did their best to avoid the rocks, legs pointed downstream, hands paddling in little circles to keep themselves afloat. But no one came. They floated as close together as they could, though Kip knew it was unwise. 2 bodies floating separately might not be remarkable, but 2 floating side by side. Still, he didn't move away. Silence settled over the boys as they came closer and closer to the bridge where their friends had died that morning. It seemed so long ago. And then Kip saw her, lying on the riverbank. The soldiers who'd murdered Issa had pulled their arrows out of her body, but aside from turning her over, they hadn't moved her corpse. She lay on her back, eyes open, head turned left toward Kip, dark hair waving in the river. One arm was raised over her head, not drifting in the current, but instead stiff as a felled tree. The underside of her arm and even her face was a horrific dark purple with pooled blood. Kip put his feet down on the slick rocks of the riverbed to go to her. He was about to stand when some sixth sense stopped him. He hesitated and, still lying in the water, looked around as much as he could. There. Standing on the bridge with only his head visible, the soldier kept watch. So they weren't stupid. They'd figured that whoever this drafter was that they'd run into earlier, he'd have the decency to come back and bury his friends. The current was carrying Kip downstream. No decision was a decision. But what could he do? Face soldiers? If there was 1, there might be 10, and if 10, maybe 100. Kip was no fighter. He was a child. He was fat, weak. 1 man would be 1 man too many. Kip turned away from Issa's corpse and lay back in the water once more. He didn't want to remember her like this anyway. A knot formed in his throat, so hard and so tight it threatened to strangle him. Only his fear of the soldier above kept him from crying as he floated under Green Bridge. He didn't even think of the dagger in its ornate case strapped to his back until they were far downstream. He could have tried. He could have at least gotten out of the water and taken a look. Issa deserved more. Soon they were drifting into town, where the river flowed in a narrower, deeper channel lined on each side with great rocks and crossed at intervals by sturdy wood bridges. Parts of the town were still on fire, though Kip didn't know whether that was because they were built of materials that were less flammable, or because the fire had spread more slowly through some areas and was only reaching some buildings now. Soon they encountered their first corpse, a horse, still harnessed to a wagon full of late-season oranges. It had been trapped in a section of the town that was now smouldering. Maddened by the fire, the mare had leapt into the river. The wagon had followed and either crushed or drowned it, spilling oranges everywhere. Kip thought it might be the Sendina family's horse and wagon. Sanson, never overly sentimental, grabbed a few oranges from the wreckage of the wagon and stuffed them in his pockets. Sanson was probably right. Kip hadn't eaten all day, not that he'd noticed until now, but he was starving. Despite feeling like he might throw up, he reached over the half-submerged horse and grabbed a few oranges too. They came closer to the water market, and it kept getting hotter. Kip heard strange screams. There were fires still burning ahead. The water market was a small